Welcome to another episode of This Fucking Guy, the series where we spotlight one fucking guy making America worse and explain why they suck. I'm Erin Ryan, host of Crooked Media's Hysteria podcast. And on this, the 40th episode of This Fucking Guy, happy 40th to us, we're discussing one of today's most successful professional victims. Anti-woke crusader turned CBS News editor-in-chief, Barry Weiss. Barry is a pioneer in the same way that actual pioneers were pioneers. That's to say that, ideologically speaking, she shows up in places where people have been living for thousands of years and acts like she discovered this cool new thing called being a center-right conservative with a Zionist streak. Weiss was born on March 25, 1984, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Her parents, Lou and Amy, owned companies called Weiss House and Weiss Lines, which sell interior design notions and flooring, respectively. Weiss and her three younger sisters were raised in the historically Jewish neighborhood of Squirrel Hill, and she had her bat mitzvah at the Tree of Life Synagogue. She was the student council president in high school and a self-described nerd. Picture Lisa Simpson, but a yinzer. She claims that her parents differed politically. Her dad was the conservative and her mom was the liberal, but in an interview with a local newspaper, they both claim that the most important issue to both of them was what was good for Israel. Writer Glenn Greenwald would later claim that Zionism has always been Barry's North Star. For our purposes, we're using the definition of Zionism contained in Encyclopedia Britannica, which is, to paraphrase here, a Jewish nationalist movement that originated in the later half of the 19th century with the goal of establishing a Jewish national state in Palestine. Today, people who call themselves Zionists tend to defend and justify Israeli actions as part of the state's right to defend itself, even as those actions appear morally indefensible to a growing number of people. Additionally, self-identified Zionists, including Barry Weiss, are often associated with anti-Arab and anti-Islam animus. Now, to be anti-Zionist is not the same as being anti-Semitic. Jewish people are among Israel's most outspoken critics. But as we'll see soon, Barry Weiss's worldview depends on the definition of anti-Zionism to encroach so far onto the definition of anti-Semitism that the two are the same. Barry didn't invent doing this, but she's certainly one of the most prominent practitioners of it. And now the word Zionism has been stretched and pulled in so many directions that it means everything and nothing. That's the bait and switch. Don't want to let Israel do whatever it wants? You're anti-Semitic. You're not anti-Semitic? Then you stand for the systematic exclusion of people critical of Israel from mainstream thought. For a more in-depth and much, much funnier version of this, please check out the podcast Bad Hasbro, hosted by my pal Matt Lieb. But back to Barry. After graduating from high school, Weiss went straight to Israel on a gap year program, where she studied at a feminist yeshiva and helped build a hospital for Bedouins in the desert. When she was there, she got into musical theater, which, come to think of it, she does kind of give theater kid who never made it out of the chorus. Weiss then attended Columbia University, where she fell in love with a female classmate by the name of Kate McKinnon. Yes, that Kate McKinnon, as in the comedian. The two dated on and off for years, and Barry claims they're still good friends. Which, in Kate's defense, if what Barry says is true, I've heard that Barry Weiss is a great hang, as she is a shitty opinion haver. And who among us doesn't have a problematic friend or two? Columbia was where Barry began her decades-long career of attacking and smearing people she deemed insufficiently pro-Israel. She was the crown princess of cancel culture before the term was even a pet expression of podcast rightoids, and all while claiming that what she was doing was actually defending freedom. George Orwell would be proud. So here's the story of Barry's first crusade. In 2002, a group called the David Project was formed to, quote, combat anti-Israel bias on university campuses and, quote, document campus harassment of Jewish students. Cutting through the media-friendly spin, the David Project is a right-wing organization founded by Ralph Avi Goldwasser and David Jacobs, two bald old men, not college kids. Rich guys pour money into campus activism all the time. The Daily Wire, Prager University. The David Project walked so Turning Point USA could strut through a corridor of pyrotechnics. In 2004, that group, in collaboration with pro-Israel students at Columbia, created a short documentary-style film called Columbia Unbecoming, which was shown several times around campus. Among the film's rapt audience was a young Barry Weiss. Columbia Unbecoming featured a series of interviews with a handful of Columbia students and one rabbi, accusing professors in the Department of Middle East and Asian Languages and Cultures Department, or MELAC, of bullying Jewish students and teaching classes that were unfairly biased against Israel. It singled out three professors specifically, George Saliba, Joseph Massad, and Hamid Dabashi.
I took Professor Saliba's Intro to Islamic Civilization. At the end of the semester, I guess the icing on the cake was that we saw a video about contemporary politics in the Middle East. And without any framing at all, we witnessed a video that showed a march of Arabs from the region, annual march, in which they hold up banners that say death to Zionism, and they chanted slogans like death to Jews. While that may be an accurate portrayal of what goes on in the Middle East, I was kind of surprised that he didn't frame it with anything like, this is not my perspective, or what you're going to see here may bother you a little bit.
Now, this video was specifically made to perpetuate one particular viewpoint, and that's that Arab professors at Columbia were targeting and intimidating Jewish students, and for that, they should be disciplined, maybe even fired. The film does a pretty shitty job of proving its case. It bleeds with histrionics, like in the clip we just watched, where it sounds like a girl was upset she didn't get a trigger warning. Now, that's the kind of thing that columnist Barry would point to as a sign of generational fragility if it had to do with any other topic. But before Barry Weiss was clutching her pearls over the perceived snowflakery of college protesters threatening free speech on campus, she was a college snowflake threatening free speech on campus. Radicalized by this highlight reel of unsubstantiated complaints, Barry and a handful of her Jewish classmates founded a group that led a campaign against the professors and named it Columbians for Academic Freedom, or CAF. It was a big enough deal that it drew the attention of prominent pro-Israel figures like then-Congressman Anthony Weiner. And the university launched an investigation into the claims that were made. But here's the thing. The film fell apart under scrutiny. For example, none of the students complaining about Professor Massad in the film had actually taken a class of his. An article about the controversy quoted Barry Weiss, who claimed that all Massad talked about in his class was Israel. Another student who had taken the same class said he'd only devoted a couple of weeks to it. The internal Columbia investigation found that there was, quote, no evidence of any statements made by the faculty that reasonably could be construed as anti-Semitic, and, quote, no basis for believing that Professor Massad systematically suppressed dissenting views in his classroom. Not only were the professors not guilty of the offenses they'd been accused of, but the report found that the professors had been victimized by a smear campaign organized by outside groups, some of which were trying to spy on the professors' classrooms. Massad eventually did get tenure. He still gets harassed quite a bit, though. Barry wasn't done. In 2007, an anthropology professor named Nadia Abu El-Haj was up for tenure at Barnard College, Columbia's all-women's sister school. Abu El-Haj had written an award-winning scholarly book called Facts on the Ground, which questioned the Zionist narrative that a long archaeological record of Jewish presence in Palestine justified the establishment of a Jewish state in the region. The campaign against Abu El-Haj's qualifications and worthiness was led by Barry Weiss's group, in cooperation once again with outside groups determined to pressure the college into denying the professor tenure. The petition, which was started by an Israeli settler, contained fabricated quotes from El-Haj's work. It still got thousands of signatures. While Weiss and company were successful in helping make Abu El-Haj's life a nightmare for a short period of time, they were ultimately unsuccessful. Nadia Abu El-Haj was granted tenure that fall after Weiss graduated. At the time, Weiss was brand new on the masthead of the opinion section of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, where she wrote a column condemning Abu El-Haj being awarded tenure called Facts in the Air. Weiss, who is neither an academic nor an anthropologist, accused Abu El-Haj's anthropological work of undermining the very nature of facts themselves. That's some mediocre white man confidence right there. After college, Weiss entered the star-making, frothing ideologue pretending to be a mild-mannered center-right opinion-haver pipeline. From Haaretz, she worked at The Forward and Tablet, and then, at just 23 years old, the Wall Street Journal opinion page snatched her up. Barry would fall under the mentorship of then-Wall Street Journal columnist Brett Stevens, whose opinions have always been about as interesting as an expired tub of plain yogurt. But they loved that shit at the New York Times, so in 2017, Weiss followed her mentor from the Wall Street Journal to the Gray Lady. Once there, she got straight to the business of being delighted by microwaved Reagan-era leftovers she'd rebranded as thrillingly naughty transgressive beliefs. Barry wasn't afraid to take bold swings, like the time she published a column about how Women's March organizers were anti-Semitic, which was a sort of rehashed version of another column she'd written earlier that year for Tablet, which also claimed that the Women's March organizers were anti-Semitic, which is a rehashed complaint she's been making against Arab Americans and Muslims since she was a wee college complainer. During her time on the Times opinion pages, she buttered her bread with columns critical of the Me Too movement. Well, not the actual Me Too movement, a version of the Me Too movement that she made up in her head by cobbling together a collage of the most extreme voices on Twitter. You'll find more straw men in Barry Weiss columns than you will in all the fields in Kansas. Take, for example, her column headlined, "The Problem with Believe All Women." Weiss argues that the Me Too movement had created an atmosphere of fear for men and given a permission structure for bad actors to exploit a cultural moment to lob false accusations. She cites the case of Roy Moore, who at the time was running for Senate in Alabama, and facing a smattering of stories that as an adult man, he'd preyed on teenage girls. One woman had approached the Washington Post, claiming that Moore had impregnated her and pressured into having an abortion. The Post reporters grew suspicious of the woman's story and discovered that she was actually part of a right-wing sting operation designed to discredit the other accusers. The Post did not believe that woman. The reporters did their jobs. There was no outcry from feminists about the Post reporter's refusal to believe her without question. But somehow, in Weiss's view, this incident revealed a fatal weakness in the Me Too movement. Now, let's stop for a second, revisit that headline. Now, see what the headline did? It puts the phrase, "believe all women," in quotes, as though it's a quotation. But in the article, the only person who says "believe all women" is Barry Weiss, who has declared it the huntress's war cry. So technically a huntress that Barry Weiss came up with said it, not Barry, I guess. To prove her case that feminism had run amok and was out to take down innocent men, Weiss quoted a tweet from a Teen Vogue columnist and claimed that countless women were sharing similar views in private. What women? How many, Barry? How do you know? I was working in a different newsroom at the time, also writing columns about the Me Too movement. Nobody serious was saying "believe all women." The phrase was "believe women," a slogan that meant take allegations of sexual misconduct seriously. To take allegations seriously is to follow up on them by looking into whether or not they are true. Some of them will turn out to be true, and some of them won't. But it was easier for people like Barry Weiss to portray the folly of the Me Too movement if she pretended that the battle cry was "believe all women," rather than engage with the complexity of reality, which was that society was grappling with how to balance justice for victims and fairness for the accused. Feminists were not in lockstep about this. There was a lot of debate and discussion. Barry pretended we were this big group of blue-haired slut walkers going around confiscating the ball sacks of men who told them they were pretty at work one time. Barry did this shit all the time. Rather than engage with reality, she engages with a sillier version of things that exist only in her imagination or on Twitter and pretends that everybody on the left is like this and then beats up on that imaginary monolith. This was on display in her hit parade of tedious contrarianism, like, "I'm glad the Dyke March banned Jewish stars," wherein she tells the story of how a pride parade in Chicago kicked out three women displaying rainbow flags with the Star of David on it. Quote, "Has there ever been a crisper expression of the consequences of intersectionality than a ban on Jewish lesbians from a Dyke March?" she wrote. Hold the phone. The words she used imply that all Jewish lesbians were banned from a march, or that the Jewish lesbians were banned because of their Jewishness, which would have been bad. But the real story is that three women carrying the one specific flag were kicked out. And that's not the same as all Jewish lesbians being banned. Furthermore, according to the Washington Post, there was more to the story. From the march organizers, the three women, quote, "repeatedly expressed support for Zionism during conversations with Chicago Dyke March Collective members. We have since learned that at least one of these individuals is a regional director for a Wider Bridge, an organization with connections to the Israeli state and right-wing pro-Israel interest groups. The Chicago Dyke March Collective is explicitly not anti-Semitic. We are anti-Zionist," the statement added. "The Chicago Dyke March Collective supports the liberation of Palestine and oppressed people everywhere." But Barry never let facts muddy up a story of the demise of reasonability at the hands of the silly and indulgent left. Her now notorious column, "We're All Fascists Now," had to have a correction tacked to it when one of the random Twitter accounts she cited as evidence of systemic oppression of conservative voices turned out to be fake. Barry Weiss's Three Cheers for Cultural Appropriation pretends that random bloggers and Twitter accounts engaging with separate, distinct discussions about the origin and ownership of specific cultural artifacts were the ones dictating what every progressive thought about everything. Now, I could go on and on about Weiss's pathological strawmanning, but I don't want to raise my blood pressure. Plenty of people have dove in on Weiss's weakness in fashioning an argument. I haven't seen as many people talk about Weiss's weakness in fashioning a joke when she tries to be funny and shits out prose that reads like a Treasury of Cathy cartoons. Folks, Humor-wise, Barry Weiss is a tote bag. She's an attitude tee knotted at the corner, worn on a 5K fun walk through Branson, Missouri. Her jokes are stale popcorn. Her piece, The Summer Bucket List of a 35-Year-Old Woman, is a litany of gentle self-deprecation that Bridget Jones would have used as an emergency maxi pad. Try not to drink more than half a bottle of Pinot Grigio on weeknights. Restart Weight Watchers. Tell Jenny to drag you to Saturday morning meetings. Get a little tan. Was this column written by the inside of those Dove chocolate wrappers? I cannot believe that this ran in the New York Times. Okay, so maybe her column, Imagining Comey's Text to His Wife, will be funnier. Here's an excerpt. 2:06 p.m., DT cornered me, telling me to drop the Flynn thing. Let it go, he just wouldn't stop. Remember what he said to Billy Bush? Was like that. 2:07 p.m., feeling bad about summer again, sad face. Tell me again about that thing you said about hindsight, need reminding. 3:16 p.m., BTW, can we get a grandfather clock for the house? Sending you some eBay links to check out. This shit makes Maureen Dowd sound like Tina Fey. No wonder she thinks her wife Nellie Bowles is the funniest writer in the world. But I want to take some time now to reflect on the legacy of a piece that aged just about as poorly as a piece of op-ed journalism can age. And that's the feature Barry wrote on the so-called intellectual dark web, or IDW. When it was published back in May 2018, Meet the Renegades of the Intellectual Dark Web, that's the real headline, was immediately met with ridicule. People called it the Intellectual Dork Web. It didn't help that the people featured on it are dorks, and that accompanying the article were portraits by Damon Winter that were so self-serious that they were silly. Winter had won the Pulitzer Prize in photojournalism for his work covering the 2008 Obama presidential campaign, and now he was taking a glamour shot of Jordan Peterson furrowing his brow. But anyway, I digress. A lot has changed since 2018, so let's catch up on all the luminaries Barry identified as the IDW. All right, so there's Sam Harris, who is largely known for palling around with the author of The Bell Curve, a widely debunked book that claims racial differences in IQ are due to inherent differences in biology. Since the piece ran, he's taken a big zag towards Zionism, argued that Islam is the motherlode of bad ideas, and has released a podcast episode titled Anti-Zionism is Anti-Semitism. There's Eric Weinstein, a stay-puffed marshmallow man-shaped scientist who has been called a physics grifter and a pseudo-intellectual charlatan by his critics, but more importantly, works closely with Peter Thiel over at Thiel Capital, and perhaps most importantly, is a pro-Israel. Also, Eric's grimacing brother Brett and his wife Heather Haying, both of whom were professors at Evergreen State College, but quit their jobs because of woke. And now they host an anti-woke podcast. Conveniently, Brett, being bullied by woke, had been the subject of another Weiss column months prior. There is also Jordan Peterson, frail uncle of the manosphere. He's written extensively about the threat of anti-Semitism after the attacks of October 7th, 2023. And in the immediate aftermath of the attack, he posted to X, "Give him hell, Netanyahu, enough is enough." And he added Benjamin Netanyahu. Now to the ladies. There's Claire Lehman of Quillette, who, you guessed it, is also a Zionist with such a virulent distaste for Islam that critics have described her as white supremacist adjacent. She's also defended Israel's slaughter of mostly civilians in Gaza. But don't worry, the dark web isn't all white. There's also Ayan Hirsi Ali, a Somali-born critic of Islam who had been a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, which is one of America's most prominent right-wing think tanks. It's hardly the wild west of renegade ideas, as Barry had characterized the IDW. In 2023, Ali converted to Christianity in preparation for what she called a civilization war that is coming for the West. Sounds cool and normal. Finally, Dave Rubin, a comedian who wasn't afraid to tell it like it is, but who also happened to coincidentally be an avowed self-proclaimed Zionist and apologist for Israeli military actions, especially in the wake of October 7th. In September 2024, 6 years after his marquee debut in the pantheon of Barry Weiss's IDW, a DOJ indictment alleged that Tenet Media, where Rubin worked, was actually covertly funded by Russian state media, which had been paying influencers, including Rubin, to push pro-Russia, pro-Trump, and anti-LGBTQ talking points. Rubin claimed he had no idea. Guitar riff! Earlier this year, Piers Morgan banned Rubin from his program after Rubin sided with Ben Shapiro on coverage of Israel. Morgan called Rubin a treasonous little weasel. And speaking of little weasels, Ben Shapiro is also one of the main dorks of Barry's Dangerous Brains Club. Ben hated the Barbie movie so much that he lit a Barbie on fire and threw it in the trash. Ben is, say it with me now, a self-proclaimed Zionist who has defended the actions of Israel. Now, not all the ascendant alt-right adjacent figures were given equal credulity in Weiss's feature. While she called Candace Owens sharp, she seemed to draw a distinction between her and the people she considered a part of the IDW. Same thing for Kanye West and Mike Cernovich. Weird that these are the figures in the clique least likely to be supportive of Israel, and each of them tends to be flat-out anti-Semitic. Looking back now, it seems like the piece was just a vehicle by which to cleave the Zionist alt-right into its own freethought collective far away from the Israel skeptics who use words like globalists. The only people who got to be in Barry's club were people who were pro-Zionist or anti-Islam enough to match Barry's worldview. That's it. It makes sense that the first two letters of IDW are also ID. Now I'm sounding like Candace Owens. Reflecting on what the members of the group had to do with her, Barry wrote, quote, "Like many in this group, I'm a classical liberal who has run afoul of the left, often for voicing my convictions and sometimes simply by accident. This has won me praise from libertarians and conservatives, and having been attacked by the left, I know I run the risk of focusing inordinately on its excesses and providing succor to some people whom I deeply oppose." Hysteria is brought to you by Honeylove. I never thought I would say I loved a bra before, but then I tried Honeylove. Honeylove bras are supportive and wire-free thanks to bonding technology that lifts without underwire. You deserve a bra that's lightweight and comfortable without sacrificing support. A great bra is the foundation for any great outfit, so I start every outfit with Honeylove. Honeylove products feature lingerie-inspired design details that you'll want to show off and high-quality fabrics that feel like a dream against skin. My favorite has always been their best-selling wireless crossover bra, and they recently launched their new crossover contour bra, which features their best-selling wireless crossover bra design, plus built-in molded light foam pads for extra support and a beautifully contoured shape. Thank goodness they're built-in. I'm so over those pads just coming out of bras. And of course, we can't forget the shapewear. Honeylove shapewear is designed to move with you. Say goodbye to pesky shapewear that rolls down as soon as you hit the dance floor. It uses targeted compression to enhance your curves instead of squeezing them. It's designed to work with your body, not against it. It's just as easy to get it on as it is to take it off, and was made with a convenient opening in the panty area for super easy bathroom trips. No costume change required. Treat yourself to the most advanced bras and shapewear on the market. For a limited time, Honeylove is offering up to 50% off site-wide during their Memorial Day sale. Use our exclusive link to shop at honeylove.com/hysteria. That's honeylove.com/hysteria. After you check out, they'll ask where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Experience the new standard in comfort and support with Honeylove. Hysteria is brought to you by ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol. Let's face it, after a night with drinks, I don't bounce back the next day like I used to. I have to make a choice. I can either have a great night or a great next day. My kids don't really care what I did the night before. They're going to wake me up at 5:15 regardless. So I need pre-alcohol in order to have an okay next day. ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's a buildup of this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for rough days after drinking. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make pre-alcohol your first drink of the night. Drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow. You know, sometimes it is a little bit of a challenge to enjoy myself on date nights, knowing that the next morning, if I go out for a cocktail, we've got a babysitter, I'm coming home at midnight, the next morning is still going to be a morning with these two little kids. So I really need to take steps to make sure that the next day doesn't make me pay so much for date nights that I never want to go on one again. From the crack of the bat at the stadium to the start of wedding season and the roar of the engines in Indy, May is packed with back-to-back reasons to be out. Don't let a rough morning after keep you on the sidelines. Drink pre-alcohol to stay ahead of it and make the most of every Saturday this month. Go to zbiotics.com/guy to learn more and get 15% off your first order when you use guy at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember to head to zbiotics.com/guy and use the code GUY at checkout for 15% off.
Catch the NBA playoffs on Sling TV, the most flexible live TV streaming service, putting consumers in control to watch games their way with flexible subscriptions. Want to catch one game or a full series on ESPN? Grab a 1, 3, or 7-day pass. If you want to catch as many games as possible, get a monthly subscription with our ABC, NBC, and ESPN combo package. Either way, Sling lets you watch the playoffs your way with no long-term contracts. Learn more at sling.com.
Weiss was one of the most popular columnists at the Times during her stint there because everybody loves a hate read. And of course, her prominence caused her detractors to visit her cancel culture queen past. Barry Weiss has attempted for years to finesse her multiple campaigns against insufficiently Zionist academics at her school into something morally consistent with her self-declared free speech advocacy. She tweeted in response to Glenn Greenwald's 2018 takedown of her, quote, "When I was an undergraduate student at Columbia, I advocated for the rights of students to express their viewpoints in the classroom." But Megan Greenwell, who had been on the staff of Columbia's campus newspaper at the time, jumped into the fray, tweeting, "Barry, I have no desire to be involved here, but your synopsis of the events of 2004-2005 is unfair. You weren't simply advocating for students' rights. You were calling professors racist. I know because I wrote or edited most of the stories about it." Greenwald then linked to a story wherein Barry Weiss claimed that professors were racists. Glenn Greenwald noted, quote, "That's what makes this whole spectacle so amazing. The New York Times is allowing one of its columnists to masquerade as a stalwart defender of campus free speech and academic pluralism while utterly ignoring and allowing her to falsely deny her own long history in trying to stigmatize and punish professors who criticized Israel, to the point where the NYCLU stepped in and denounced her campaign as a dangerous threat to academic freedom." Even Greenwald's spicy anti-Weiss rants aren't enough to embarrass Barry, though. In 2019, Weiss stuck her nose into a campus fight at Stanford University. This one was over the Jewish cartoonist Eli Valley, whose work had caricatured right-wing Jewish figures. Weiss retweeted a student op-ed comparing Valley's work to Nazi propaganda. So the campus talk from a guy who draws silly pictures was forced to be relocated to a secure facility off campus due to concerns about safety. People love to hate on Barry because in addition to being smug and wrong, she was also a dork. It was easy to dunk on her. One of Barry's cringiest moments came in 2018. It was the Winter Olympics, women's figure skating, the big show. Japanese-American skater Mirai Nagasu landed a triple axel. In a swell of patriotic pride, Weiss tweeted a video of the skill with the caption, "Immigrants, they get the job done." God, I wish Alyssa were here to roll her eyes with me, but since she's not, I'll do it. This is a bastardization of the line from the Broadway musical Hamilton, which in 2018 was already considered to be a little choogy. But to make matters worse, the line isn't "immigrants, they get the job done." It's "immigrants, we get the job done." Plus, Magasu was born in the U.S. She's not an immigrant. She's just Asian. People on Twitter were quick to correct Weiss, but Barry decided to just tweet through it. "Yes, yes, I realize. Felt the poetic license was kosher." A lot of people who already hated Barry Weiss got mad online about it, which actually turned out to be great for Barry Weiss since it helped her meet her daily minimum value of vitamin V for victim. Woke had done it again. Cancel culture run amok. By now, we've probably established the Barry Weiss MO. Act like an asshole. When called out on it, cry about how you're actually the victim. People who have talked about bad relationships in therapy probably know this as DARVO, deny, attack, reverse, victim, and offender. Barry's inability to tell the difference between real life and Twitter was starting to annoy her coworkers. She'd use her Twitter account to attack and belittle her New York Times colleagues' work. As an opinion writer, she was subject to more lax social media policing than those who were actually reporting and editing stories. By the summer of 2020, it appeared that Barry was frustrated by the fact that no matter how big of an asshole she was at work, she couldn't manage to get herself fired. After all, what better evidence that cancel culture is a thing than to get canceled yourself? She almost got there when she involved herself in the newsroom fight over Senator Tom Cotton's op-ed, urging the president to send troops to liberal cities that were sites of protests of the murder of George Floyd. Cotton's column, "Send in the Troops," prompted hundreds of Times employees to sign onto a letter condemning its publication, and for editorial page editor James Bennett to resign. Weiss was a huge dick about the whole thing, breathlessly describing an intra-newsroom fight between the mostly young wokes and the mostly 40-plus liberals. But a month later, when Barry herself resigned, she accused the paper and her colleagues of bullying her. In her resignation flounce, which she posted to her own website, she wrote, quote, "Several colleagues perceived to be friendly with me were badgered by coworkers. My work and my character are openly demeaned on company-wide Slack channels where masthead editors regularly weigh in. There, some coworkers insist I need to be rooted out if this company is to be a truly inclusive one, while others post axe emojis next to my name. Still, other New York Times employees publicly smear me as a liar and a bigot on Twitter," not on Twitter, "with no fear that harassing me will be met with appropriate action. They never are." There are terms for all of this: unlawful discrimination, hostile work environment, and constructive discharge. I'm no legal expert, but I know that this is wrong. It's hard to take Barry's claims of being a free speech martyr seriously when she had a regular column at one of the most widely read newspapers in the world and had the ability to commission pieces from other writers of her choosing and was featured regularly alongside her new television bestie Bill Maher on his TV show for Boomer Uncles. In fact, earlier in the very letter in which she accused the Times of marginalizing conservatives and centrist voices, she'd bragged about how many centrist and conservative voices she'd brought to the paper. No matter whether this characteristic Weissian display of curated victimhood was part of a long-planned move into independent journalism or truly the result of Weiss being the victim of woke, Barry was well on her way to her next chapter, Substack. Weiss's publication was first known as Common Sense and then The Free Press. Its mission statement was a regurgitated version of Weiss's resignation letter from The Times, and people fucking loved it. Partly because it reflected a general unease vast swaths of America's normies had with the power they perceived the left had over culture. But it did so in such a way that enabled its readers to assure themselves that they were still superior to Fox News viewers, even though they believed pretty much exactly what the Fox viewers believed, for the same reasons. It was MAGA, but pH balanced for people who drink red wine and downhill ski. Even before it attracted subscribers, it attracted the attention and money of billionaires who needed Americans to be mad at woke so they wouldn't turn their anger at them. It's a tried and true diversion tactic, but hey, it works. Weiss turned on the charm she's famous for in person, and mainstays on the pantheon of Silicon Valley douchebags like Mark Andreessen opened their wallets to her. She raked in gobs of seed money. But Barry didn't know what she was doing. Here are some ringing endorsements of Weiss's prowess as an editor-in-chief from her former employees, from Claire Malone's reporting at The New Yorker. Quote, Barry had no idea how newsrooms worked, but she knew that she needed to call her operation a newsroom. I don't think if you sat her down and said, can you explain the difference between a news story, an investigative story, and an enterprise story, she could tell you what it means, and she wasn't going to let that slow her down. Here's another. She was so brilliant and charismatic, and if she started a church, we all would have joined. And within a couple of months, we all wanted to jump out a window. She was completely stubborn and couldn't take guidance. The Free Press promised its readers that it would tell the truth and let its readers make up their own minds. But critics took note of how far short they fell of this. One critical post on the Unpopulist noted a few low notes, like the Time columnist Eli Lake compared the actions of 20-something fuckboys tasked with slashing the federal budget under Elon Musk's Doge program to the founding fathers, James Madison, Big Balls, basically the same guy. In another post that aged poorly, a Free Press writer prematurely thanked Doge for successfully rooting out waste from the federal budget. Subsequent analysis has found that the program actually cost the government money and achieved nothing but sowing disarray. But hey, at least it got rid of DEI hires, whatever those are. Speaking of DEI hires, the Free Press's co-founder was none other than Barry Weiss's kid sister, Susie Weiss. Susie Weiss is a self-satisfied little shit who made her debut 8 years prior, when in 2013 she'd written a column for the Wall Street Journal, where her big sister worked, weird, bemoaning the fact that she hadn't gotten into any of the Ivy League colleges she'd applied to. She mused that maybe if she wasn't a boring white girl, if she'd, say, worn a headdress to school or had two moms, she'd have gotten into Penn. Here, I'll let little Susie Weiss explain it on the Today Show.
Well, it's a funny story, actually. The piece was written, I got rejected from a bunch of schools in one day, and like any teenager, I'm sure we're like millions of teenagers that day, I was crying to my mom, and she said, I cannot hear about this anymore, just go talk to someone else. So I called my sister, and I was crying, but she was hysterically laughing, and she said, go write this down. Yeah. So I did, and this is what came out of it. Let's see, I make fun of two moms having killer SAT scores, the diversity, it's a satire. That's the point. Just like 30 Rock is a satire, which pokes fun at things that are politically correct. That's what I was trying to do. Diversity, I think, is a wonderful thing. I think it's great. I think all colleges should have a holistic approach to every college applicant. I do, however, think that in this day and age, we're being judged on things that we cannot control.
Oh, the irony of a high schooler who got published in the Wall Street Journal because of who her sister was and whose entire professional career is because her sister keeps giving her things, complaining about unfair advantages. Meritocracy at work, am I right? But back to Barry's publication. If there were a museum of bad opinions, this Free Press article from April 2025 would get its own gallery wall. It was by Bataya Ungar Sargon and headlined, I used to hate Trump. Now I'm a MAGA lefty. The deck was, the president is giving the working class its best shot at the American dream in 60 years. That's why I support him. The piece also claimed that Trump's tariff scheme would fix America's masculinity crisis and restart American manufacturing. Did that happen? Anybody? Did that happen? It's rare that an opinion turns this bad this quickly. Like Barry's writing, the Free Press relied on cheap tactics that were tough to refute. The Unpopulist put it this way, quote, "The Free Press uses subjective first-person reporting to render judgments on institutions that are hard to falsify. Unlike ordinary reporters, these authors don't have to obtain corroboration from different sources, seek comment from the institutions being investigated, and then adjust the article's framing if they're offered valid evidence that casts doubt on their working thesis. This genre of journalism can be done well, but the Free Press uses it to convey its twin conceits, that establishment voices are not to be trusted, and that the Free Press alone is a trustworthy source that speaks uncomfortable truths that others suppress," end quote. As a banger. Meanwhile, Barry was out to smoke out woke where it slept, college campuses. In 2021, she and a handful of other insufferables, including one of the co-founders of Palantir, founded the University of Austin. Not to be confused with the University of Texas at Austin, which is a real school. UATX, as it was known, touted itself as a merit-first institution of higher learning. Everybody who met the academic requirements for admission and wasn't an obvious red flag got in. Its faculty consists of professors who were canceled at other institutions. It is unaccredited, it doesn't charge tuition, and it only offers one degree. Curiously, it's absent from Barry Weiss's Wikipedia page, but you know what the University of Austin does have? A bust of Barry Weiss on display in the library. It was made by an AI 3D printer. And judging by how little that thing looks like Barry Weiss, I think we can rest assured that AI will not be replacing sculptors anytime soon. In October 2025, Paramount Skydance purchased the Free Press for $150 million because what is money? That move was made by David Ellison, weird little son of Larry Ellison, a billionaire MAGA acolyte. The younger Ellison appointed Barry Weiss to be editor-in-chief of CBS News. Now, Barry had no relevant TV experience and, in fact, had never done any real news gathering herself before beyond cherry-picking tweets that helped her build her straw leftist. And the Free Press had about 60 employees, while CBS News had about 1,200. Weiss would soon prove to be exactly the idiot that people feared she'd be. She appointed as her deputy Adam Rubenstein, who had edited that atrocious Tom Cotton New York Times piece that urged Trump to send troops into American cities to attack protesters after the death of George Floyd. Barry ended her first meeting with the entire newsroom with the cheer, "Let's do the fucking news." So funny. Words of would have sounded natural emerging from the mouth of Succession's Kendall Roy in a scene meant to make Kendall look and sound like an entitled doofus who was in over his head. Barry traveled everywhere with bodyguards, which her colleagues made fun of behind her back. She urged colleagues to turn in more coverage of protests in Iran after seeing some videos that turned out to be from protests from 3 years ago, which her colleagues also made fun of behind her back. Then the layoffs started. 8 on-air personalities got the axe. All were women. CBS News employees also noted that staffers of color tended to lose their jobs while white employees got moved to other positions. So how did Barry do the fucking news? Well, Weiss has a thwarted theater kid's desire to be cast in the leading role, despite having the on-camera charisma of instant mashed potatoes. She moved into the office once occupied by CBS head anchor Scott Pelley, overlooking the entire newsroom. When her network landed a coveted interview with Erica Kirk, whose husband Charlie had been publicly assassinated months prior, Barry volunteered to handle the town hall-style event herself, rather than tapping a more seasoned actual journalist to handle it.
One of the things that has happened over the 3 months since Charlie was murdered is that people have gone through the thousands, maybe tens of thousands of hours of words he produced. And I want to read a few that have captured the most attention, especially on the political left, okay?
Yeah.
"Some gun deaths were, quote, unfortunately worth it to preserve the Second Amendment," he said. Acknowledging that he wishes he didn't feel this way, he said, "I'm sorry, if I see a black pilot, I'm going to be like, boy, I hope he's qualified." He said the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was a mistake. Now, I realize that all of those quotes come from longer conversations that he had on his show.
Correct.
But he did say those things.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie is being memorialized by many people as a person who promoted civil discourse, as a person who said, come to the front of the line, let's have a civil conversation.
Mm-hmm.
How do you square that with the statements I just read?
I would love for everyone to be able to watch the full and entire clip of what he said. Charlie didn't care what skin color you were. He didn't care what religion you were. His favorite word was earn. He loved knowing that people worked hard to earn what they got.
He just died, and his favorite word is earn?
He worked so hard to build Turning Point USA. My husband is not to be deteriorated to two sentences. Mm-hmm. He's not. He is a thought leader. And he was brilliant of a man.
This whole thing was so confusing. They were both acting, and they're both bad at acting. Erica acted possessed. Barry did her best impression of somebody that knew what she was doing. Why was it a town hall? What was the purpose of the event? Who was the event for? Unfortunately, none of those questions were answered prior to its execution. The piece, which aired on a Saturday night, was a ratings bust, even with the alley-oop assist of the Army-Navy game as a lead-in. It turns out that Weiss and David Ellison overestimated how many American conservatives would turn away from the leg cams and bottle blondes of Fox News to watch a frumpy bisexual interview an unsettling widow. Glenn Greenwald, perhaps the winner of the biggest Barry Weiss hater award, which... no hate from me. Congrats, Glenn Greenwald. Pointed out in the aftermath of that event that despite the fact that CBS News has 7 million YouTube subscribers, the town hall had only racked up 72,000 YouTube views in 2 days. Then there was the DeCoppel debacle. Hey, that almost rhymes. Weiss took her hatchet to the CBS morning and evening shows at once by moving Tony DeCoppel from the former to the latter, alienating viewers of both in the process. Why Tony DeCoppel? It could have been that back in 2024, CBS News had spiked an interview that DeCoppel had conducted with Ta-Nehisi Coates. Coates was promoting a book he'd written that was sympathetic to the suffering of Palestinians. DeCoppel, whose ex-wife and 2 kids live in Israel, compared Coates to a terrorist. Somebody leaked audio of the meeting killing the piece to the Free Press, and Weiss published it. Now, I'm sure it was a coincidence that DeCoppel was the one who got the nod for the evening news, based entirely on merit. On DeCoppel's first broadcast anchoring the evening news, Weiss fucked with his teleprompter copy before broadcast, leading to this embarrassing on-air moment.
All right, to other news, as you just heard from Jill. Well, to other news now, to Governor Walz. No, we're going to do Mark Kelly. First day, big problems here. Are we going to Kelly here, or are we going to go to Jonah Kaplan? We're doing Mark Kelly. Possibly demoted from his retired rank of captain in the Navy.
I'm Ron Burgundy? This is why you don't hire bloggers to run TV shows. In January, Zateo's Prem Thacker posted a photo to Blue Sky of a CBS News set surrounded by Jack Daniels branding with the word Whiskey Fridays with Tony DeCoppel positioned in the center. According to Thacker, quote, some staff were only first made aware of it as they encountered CBS testing out set designs of a faux-stocked bar in the newsroom, featuring a large sponsor banner for Jack Daniels. Thankfully, that never materialized, although it could have been, I don't know, maybe interesting. In the ensuing months, DeCoppel grimaced and mugged as he logged more embarrassing moments, like the time he glazed Marco Rubio as the ultimate Florida man, another time he did an awkward man-on-the-street-style interview where he asked randos in Grand Central Station to pronounce his last name, which I get the conceit behind, as for months I was calling him Tony Dracula. But Weiss wasn't done sucking ass. Her meddling has nearly tanked the credibility of CBS News' flagship show, 60 Minutes. In January, Weiss swooped in at the last minute to spike a segment on CECOT using the flimsy excuse that they hadn't gotten a response from the Trump White House. The end result was a textbook example of the Streisand effect, trying to conceal something from the public, but the effort to conceal it only draws more attention to the thing you're attempting to conceal. The segment aired in Canada, was ripped and uploaded to social media, and was viewed millions of times. Barry looked like an idiot. In February, CBS News announced that it was bringing longevity author and health influencer Peter Attia on as a contributor. But soon his name appeared in the Jeffrey Epstein files. His name appeared in the Jeffrey Epstein files 1,700 times. Turns out not only was Attia quack adjacent, he was also pedophile adjacent. In one email, Attia assured Epstein that pussy is indeed low carb. In another, he told Epstein that the biggest problem with being his friend was that, quote, the life you lead is so outrageous and yet I can't tell a soul. In another email, Epstein informed Attia that he'd gotten a fresh shipment. God, why do these guys always sound like they're flirting with each other? Attia had provided referrals to Epstein, said he could help him extend his life by 5 years if only to have more sex, and stayed in an apartment owned by Epstein. Now, the grossest detail of this already very gross story is that in his book, Attia had recalled staying in New York when his infant son had a heart attack, remaining there for work. But the Epstein files revealed that the day after his son was rushed to the hospital via ambulance in San Diego, Peter Attia was meeting with Jeffrey Epstein. Now, a sensible person would think this person is toxic. Get this trash out of my newsroom. Get them off my network. But not Barry. Barry dug in. An internal struggle ensued. Finally, after weeks of back and forth, Attia resigned. In early April, Zateo reported that Barry was at it again with the newsroom meddling, this time on a piece that aired on CBS News Sunday morning. The piece, which had been in the works for months, focused on Israeli archaeological digs in occupied West Bank territory. Sources who spoke with Zatteo say that Barry jumped in and messed with the script and deceptively edited some interviews in a way that upset one of the interview subjects, a Palestinian cultural heritage researcher named Zayed Azhari. One CBS News staffer referred to Barry's move as pulling a C-cut. I guess we can call it that now instead of the Streisand effect, right? Pulling a C-cut? I don't know. I like Streisand effect. Perhaps if she'd been doing the fucking news rather than fighting the insidious forces of woke or behaving like a Netanyahu propagandist, she'd have noticed CBS News hemorrhaging viewers. In April, CBS Evening News boasted its second lowest overall viewership ever for the month. And in the 25 to 54 demographic, well, lowest ratings ever. Just for comparison, the number one nightly news broadcast, ABC World News Tonight with David Muir, averaged 8.537 million total viewers and 1.56 million demo viewers during that time. Barry and Tony's CBS Evening News averaged 3.771 million total viewers and 467,000 viewers in the adults 25 to 54 demographic for the week of April 20th. Now, there were people who said when Barry Weiss took over CBS News, perennially the third place nightly news broadcast, that the only direction to go was up. But Barry showed them all, and in true contrarian fashion, has taken the venerated journalism outlet straight down. If past is prologue, this means Barry Weiss is about to be promoted to an even bigger job, for which she's even less qualified. So there you have it, folks, Barry Weiss, the woman who has boldly gone where many, 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 many white guys in golf carts have gone before. And because it's just me this time, I'm going to make the unilateral decision about where she lies on her matrix of fucking guys. Where do I think she is? I think that she is a true-believing zealot, and I think she's a scheming sociopath. I will not be answering any follow-up questions. I've been talking for over an hour, guys. This is too much talking. That about wraps up the time we have for this episode of This Fucking Guy. If you like what you've seen, hit the like button, share with your friends, and leave us a comment if you've got an idea for a future fucking guy subject. This episode was written and researched by me, Erin Ryan. Claire Fogarty did our fact-checking, all the rest of the credits, as well as links to our sources like Claire Malone's work at The New Yorker and Glenn Greenwald's work for The Intercept can be found in our show notes. Trust me, guys, the bibliography is always a fun read. Take care, be well, stay woke, and fuck that guy.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.